All right, sounds good. So let's officially start our call. Again, my name is Scott Whitaker, and I want to welcome you to your monthly coaching call with R. Don Robbins as part of your all-digital membership with How to Manage a Small Law Firm. So I want to welcome you to today's call. If you dialed in early, you heard us talking about policies and procedures. If you saw my email, you know that's the theme for today's coaching call. So let me give you a couple of housekeeping notes that you can take advantage of. One is we are going to do a live Q&A as part of our call today, and later on I'll bring our operator onto the line. She'll give you instructions. But if for some reason you don't want to join on the call live and be able to ask your question directly to John, you can always email me your question. Just reply to any of the emails I send you, or my email address is Scott Whitaker, ScottWhitaker at howtomanage.com, and I'll be glad to ask your question directly to R. John and have him answer it. And then, of course, R. John's going to share with us about policies and procedures. So, R. John, welcome to the call. Thank you for everyone joining in, and let's get started.
Well, thank you for organizing this, Scott. Should I just dive in, or do you have something else you want to say to get everyone started?
Now, let's just go ahead and dive in.
Okay, so the theme of the call, in my opinion, is not policies or procedures. And I'm sorry for everyone who called in to the call thinking that you're going to call in to learn about policies and procedures. And I'm more sorry for everyone who didn't dial in thinking that, oh, this is policies and procedures and I'm not interested. The real theme of this call is sanity. And it's a choice that each of us gets to make. I'm not going to say has to make. I'm going to say we get to make this choice. And the choice is, do I want to live a life of sanity, or do I want to continue to have insanity in my life because of how my business operates? So years ago, I made the choice that I am going to enjoy sanity in my life. Now, that doesn't mean that I am expecting to ever achieve perfection, and I certainly have not. Things go wrong all the time in my business. Things are not always perfect in my life, but it's a choice of living a sane life versus settling for, tolerating, putting up with, and in some cases, people even start, you know, bragging and taking pride in living a life of insanity. And, you know, I can't think of anything more insane than taking pride in living a life of insanity. So let me talk about what I mean by sanity and insanity first. Should I start there, Scott, or do you want me to go somewhere else?
Nope, let's start right there.
All right, so a life of insanity as the owner of a small law firm, or any business for that matter, is a life where your priorities, your schedule, the most important decisions about the most important things in your life all get dictated to you at the whim of other people and circumstances. You know, people go around saying the most important thing in my life is my children. But then when you actually peel the veneer off, peel the cover off, lift the hood off the engine bay of their business, you realize that their children really are not their priority, because they're not taking action to make their children their priority. They're just paying lip service to the idea. Or people will say, my freedom is my priority. But when you look at the decisions they're making, the choices they're making in their life and in their business, freedom is not really their priority, because their actions are not reasonably calculated to give them any kind of freedom. Saying that you're going to make your children your priority, saying you're going to make freedom your priority, saying you're going to live life on your terms, but setting yourself up to constantly have to take shit from other people and let other people's priorities and other people's goals and other people's motives and other people's whims dictate your life to you, That is insane. Now, if you go out, if you start off and say, my goal and my intention is to be a doormat to all of my employees, and my goal is to be a doormat to all of my clients, and my goal is to be a doormat to all of my referral sources, and my goal is to be a doormat to everyone around me, and you don't pay attention to any kind of policies, don't pay attention to any kind of procedures, that is, ironically, less insane because that's what you said you wanted to do, and that's what you get. So it's really all about sanity. And let me give you an example of what a sane life looks like. A sane life, and this is according to me, and people could disagree, but in my book, a sane life is a life where we can look out at our calendar for the next 12 weeks, even for the next 12 months, and be proactive in our decisions. We can make plans about where we want to be, what we want to do, who we want to invest our time with, and be proactive and in control of our life. You know, Scott, every quarter we have a new enrollment for prospective new members of how to manage a small law firm. That's once every 90 days. And every quarter I am reminded just how many lawyers have zero control over their schedule and therefore zero control over their lives. And we'll run into lawyers who say, oh, I really need to go there. I really need to do that. Really need to check this thing out. I mean, it does come with 100% money back guarantee. So why the hell wouldn't you at least check it out? And they're like, yeah, I got to check this thing out. And they're like, okay, well, the next one is in 90 days, 50 days, 60 days, 45 days, 30 days, 20 days, whatever, you name it. And every quarter we get, I mean, dozens and dozens and dozens of lawyers like, oh, I can't do that because, and then they always have like an excuse because of their calendar. Now, some of the reasons they can't make it are legitimate reasons. I can't make it. My daughter's getting married. Good. You should make that a priority in your life. I can't make it. I've got a big trial scheduled. Okay, good. You have to make that a priority in your life. I can't make it. I'm taking a vacation. Good. You should make taking a vacation with your family a priority. But we get lawyers who quarter after quarter after quarter after quarter, and we got some people who have been kicking the can down the road for more than a year, sometimes even longer, and they just can never take control of their calendar and make a commitment to be somewhere and to do something. And the reason why I say that's insane is because, you know, sooner or later, inevitably, all of us have to know we are going to be called upon to be somewhere and do something in an emergency for a loved one or for a client, or it's just going to be a really amazing opportunity that we're not going to want to miss out on. And if we fail to put basic policies and basic procedures and basic systems in place for our business today, you know, that's the same thing as traveling through time into that future day when an emergency happens and saying, I'm sorry, I can't possibly be there on account of the fact that I'm choosing, because I chose a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, whenever the choice was made, to live a life of insanity where I'm a doormat to everyone around me and can't make my family a priority. So it's really all about sanity. Policies plus procedures. Policies added together with procedures equal systems. And the goal is to have systems managing your business, systems that run the marketing, systems that convert prospective clients into paying clients with the sales, systems that get the work done in a consistent, predictable, reliable way to set standards, systems that keep the team accountable, the staff accountable to operating against those standards, systems that control the finances of your business. The systems run the business, and then you hire people and train them to those systems. Now, the way most lawyers do this, unfortunately, is they don't think about systems at all. and instead they depend on superstars. We've got 24 or 25 between our outside CEO, COO, and CFOs. If you think of them as lawyers, if we were a traditional law firm, you would say we have 24 lawyers in our law firm. They're outside CEOs, they're outside COOs, they're outside CFOs. These are people with MBAs and CPAs and, very, very accomplished professionals who have run successful law firms and other successful businesses who provide our outside CEO, outside COO, and outside CFO services. The point is, Scott, that in the last 12 months, we have lost four of them. One of them we lost because this person was not meeting our prescribed standards. They weren't living up to our systems, and we had to terminate this person. One person had to quit because of some extenuating situation going on in his family. One person quit, unfortunately, without any notice, and in violation of our policies. And one person unexpectedly died. But through this all, our business did not miss a beat. You know, our members kept getting services. If you were to look at our cash flow, if you were to look at our revenues, if you were to look at any historical record of our business performance over the last 12 months, you would be hard pressed to see where these things happened based on the performance of the business. And that is because the system is bigger than anyone who runs it. The system is bigger than any of us, including myself. I even had some challenges in the past year that prevented me from being able to do some things that I had originally said that I had originally wanted to do. And the business kept chugging along because the systems run the business. When the day comes that you sell your law firm, and everyone on the call should be thinking about selling your law firm someday, you're either going to sell it voluntarily on your terms and have some control over the negotiation with the buyer and the price and the terms, or it's going to be sold involuntarily by your creditors while you look on, or it's going to be sold involuntarily by your estate after you die. But sooner or later, your law firm is going to be sold, unless you just shut it down, I guess. But sooner or later, your law firm is going to be sold. And you should be looking forward to that and making decisions based on the inevitable expectation that the business will be sold and ultimately what the buyer is going to value if they are an educated buyer, what they're going to be valuing above and beyond everything else. And Scott, this would be a really interesting topic for another of these trainings. It's some basic financial literacy to help everyone understand the difference between a balance sheet and a profit and loss statement and cash flow projections and, where real equity in a law firm is, because a lot of lawyers don't understand that, and that's what allows them to miss these important points, which one day, usually after it's too late, they wake up and realize, oh, crap, I missed that. But when the buyer comes along to value your firm, the most valuable asset that they're going to value is the systems, right? Because they're not going to value your office space. There's not a whole lot of equity in your office space on account of the fact that your office space is presumably being rented out at market value. So I'm not going to pay you a premium just for the privilege of taking over your lease. So there's no real equity there. There's no equity in most law firms in the fixtures and the equipment and the software because presumably, it's worth what you paid for it, and usually it's worth less than what you paid for it because of depreciation. So it's not like I'm going to come in and write you a big check for the equipment or the furniture or the software over and above what you paid for it or over and above what it's worth, because I could just go out and buy it new for usually less than what you owe on it or what you got into it. So there's no equity in the physical plant, meaning the physical space or the equipment or the furniture or that, you know, Lincoln freed the slaves. So it's not like I'm going to be able to, not like I'm going to buy your staff from you. I might be willing to pay you a little something if you've got a team already in place, but I'm only going to be willing to pay you for your team, for having the team in place, if the team is working according to systems. I'm not going to be willing to pay you a premium for a superstar who has no systems to support him or her, because I understand, if I'm an educated, sophisticated buyer, I understand that the superstar without systems is like, you know, one bad step away from getting hit by a bus, and there goes all the equity. So, you know, I'm not going to pay a lot for that. What I'm going to pay for, and when you see law firms being bought and sold, which, you know, if anyone on the call doubts that law firms are bought and sold on a regular basis, I would encourage you to do a little research and find out that people are buying and selling law firms all the time. And a lot of the equity that they're paying for comes from the existence and the maturity and the development of the systems that keep the marketing working, the systems that keep the sales working, converting prospective clients into new clients, the systems that keep the work getting done by a staff, the systems that keep the staff in check and keep the staff motivated and keep the staff trained, the systems that control the financials of the firm. The systems are what really make the law firm work. And when you've got those systems, then you can have sanity. And the systems are based on two things, policies plus procedures. Policies are the rules. Procedures are the instructions. You might want to write this down. Policies are the rules. Procedures are the instructions. Policies are the rules for who does what by when and why. Procedures are the instructions for how they do it, using what tools, using what resources, pursuant to what standards and checklists and things like that. Policies are the rules. Procedures are the instructions. You put a policies together with procedures, you get a system. Now, there's two different kinds of policies to pay attention to. There are internal policies, and there are external policies. Internal policies are the rules that govern everyone internal to the business. And as a very general but a very reliable rule of thumb, internal policies govern everyone that you or the business write a check to. If you are paying someone, they are subject to your internal policies, because you can basically say, a condition of my being willing to pay you is your willingness to agree to abide by and respect my internal policies. That's why they're internal policies. And if a person says, I'm not willing to abide by or comply with these policies, you have the right to say, well, then I'm not willing to employ you and I'm not going to pay you. So internal policies. And there are 12 key basic foundational internal policies, which, Scott, I'm not going to go into all of them here because, quite frankly, I don't have them on the top of my head. And the reason I don't have them on the top of my head is because I wrote them down. So I wouldn't have to walk around with these on the top of my head. That was a system. I wrote something down. That's a simple system. But everyone who is listening to this call has access to lessons on the key internal policies, the 12 key internal policies. External policies are rules that govern the firm's interaction with everyone external to the firm, meaning everyone that you're not paying money to. That would be judges, clients, opposing counsel. Those are really the three external parties, classes of parties, that your external policies govern. And if anyone listening to this is thinking, yeah, right, that's a joke, that's bullshit, judges are not going to respect my external policies, respectfully, you are mistaken. We've got solo and small law firm owners all over the country in all different practice areas who have judges and opposing counsel who do respect their firm's external policies? 100%? No, of course not. Half the time or better? Yeah, at least half the time, usually more than half the time. A lot of it comes from when the judge or when the opposing counsel says something or does something, and the lawyer can say, you know, respectfully, that violates the the policies of my firm. You'd be surprised how often judges don't even question that. You see, if you were working for a big law firm, maybe an Am Law 100 firm with hundreds of lawyers and multiple offices and layers of administration, and there was a policy for what you could or could not do. For example, you can't, you know, that before you can commit to a court date, you have to check, you know, and do and verify whatever. You know, and if you didn't have a choice, because that was the policy of the firm that you worked for, and you went to court and the judge wanted you to do something that violated the policies of your firm, you would be able to say with confidence, respectfully, Your Honor, the policy of my firm is blah, 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 XYZ, 123, whatever it is. And most judges work for a firm and understand that these are the practical realities of being a lawyer. And most judges respect those policies. But if you don't have any policies, then, you know, or if you're just making them up on the fly, you know, judges will say, well, then why should I bother respecting it if you don't respect it enough to even write it down, document it, and defend it? Which brings me to the next point, which is, if you don't respect your own rules enough to write them down, how can you ever expect staff to respect the rules? And everywhere I go, Scott, I run into lawyers who, you know, this policies in particular really sets off, it like touches a nerve with lawyers. And they'll say, well, why bother writing any of this stuff down, because no one's going to respect it anyway. To which I respond and say, have you ever actually written any rules down? Well, no, because why should I bother? Because no one's going to respect them anyway. To which I usually respond and say, well, have you ever considered the possibility that maybe the reason no one respects your rules is because you don't respect your rules enough to write them down? At which point, I often don't get invited back. But, you know, it's sort of an obvious question, right? You know?
Yeah.
So the theme of this whole thing is systems. Systems are built on policies and procedures. Policies are the rules. There's internal rules and external rules. Procedures are the instructions, the checklists, the templates, the how-tos, if you will. You put policies together, rules of who is supposed to do what by when, using what tools and resources, and why. The why is what's usually missing that takes them from mediocre to really good and gets people to buy into them. That's what you see missing in a lot of policies in law firms is the why. Why does this policy exist? What purpose is it meant to serve? You put those policies together with procedures. You get systems. You build a law firm based on systems, and you have sanity. Last point that I'm going to make before we go to Q&A. Are you ready to go to Q&A soon?
Yeah, I'm ready, and I got a couple things to add to what you're sharing here.
Okay, last thing I'm going to say before we go to Q&A is well, let's just go to Q&A, and we'll get to that later.
All right, sounds good. Let me invite our operator onto the line, and she's going to give instructions on how to get in the queue to ask questions of Arjan. And then while she's doing that, I'll share a couple things as well that Arjan, you sparked. So, Carrie, if you would, come on the line, give everyone instructions on how to get in the queue.
Absolutely. If you have a question at this time, all you need to do is press *1 on your phone. Once again, that's *1 that gets you into the question queue, and we'll take all questions in the order that they are received.
Okay, so if you have a question, press *1, and only press it one time, because if you press it twice, then it'll take you out of the queue. So just press it one time, And Carrie, our operator, she'll isolate your phone line. She'll bring you on to the line with Arjun and myself. You'll be able to ask your question directly to Arjun and give a response. And by the way, this is a great opportunity, even if you don't have a question, it's a great opportunity to learn from other people's questions and, you know, learn from them because we've got all different practices. We've got all different, you know, everybody's in a different level of their business and how long they've been practicing. So a great opportunity. You know, Arjun, you know, in talking about systems, you know, one of the things I've always believed is that the results you're getting are from the systems you have in place. So if you think about, you know, your law firm, and you think about the areas that are causing you stress, the areas that are causing you frustration, that is a good time to go back and double check the systems that you have in place. Look again at the procedures that you've written or need to write maybe, and look at those policies that you've set up, because if you're getting stress and there's frustration or there's some sort of just friction going on in your law firm, it is most likely based upon the systems that you've put in place, which then the systems are broken down into these procedures along with the policies. And sometimes the policies and procedures that we've put in place will get us to a certain level of growth. They will cause growth to take place. But then we'll get to that barrier where all of a sudden the systems that we put in place got us to that point, but now we have to go back and we have to readjust the systems. We have to readjust the procedures, maybe even revisit the policies that we put in place because they only got us to a certain level within your business, within your firm. So if you're thinking about, hey, this sounds really good, you know, policies, I've got clarity on what policies are. I've got clarity on what procedures are. Putting them together equals my systems, which are going to give me the sanity that Arjun was describing. But where do I start? Well, I would encourage you to look at what area in your law firm is causing you some frustration. What area in your law firm is causing you to lose sleep at night? And then go back and say, okay, this is the area that is causing me the frustration the most. What are the systems that I have in place? What are the procedures? What are the policies that I have in place? And what needs to be adjusted? What maybe new policies or procedures need to be written? What old policies and procedures maybe have need to be edited? What, you know, maybe what's missing altogether in the way of those policies and procedures? So I would just add to that a little bit, Arjun, in the sense of the results that you're getting from your law firm are directly tied to your systems, which equals your policies and your procedures. Anything you would add to that, yeah, to share more?
Yeah, and I know we've got people on the line who want to ask questions, and I know we've got people who have written in questions, and I want to make sure we get time to that. I just want to challenge everyone who's listening to this and everyone who listens to the recording afterwards. You know, Scott, I don't know how to say this politely. It's going to come off like I'm being a jerk, but I really don't mean it like a jerk. And if this is what instigates you to really take this stuff seriously and you wake up in a few years and your life is just like a million times better, then maybe this is the kick in the ass that you needed. If you don't take advantage of the opportunity to ask questions on calls like this, it just tells me a lot about how serious you are about building a successful business. You know, when I was struggling financially, I subscribed to digital virtual membership programs like this. And, you know, back then, $500 a month was a lot of money for me. And even though I knew I could listen to the recordings later, I mean, it was very, very rare that I would miss a call. I always made the calls, almost always made the calls. I mean, obviously there were instances where I couldn't, but I made it a priority to be on those calls. And it's kind of funny. I'm now friends with a lot of the people who run those businesses. They were my mentors. Now some of them are paying me for advice on how to run a business. And it's funny sometimes to go back and listen to those old recordings. And there I am. I'm asking questions, and I'm asking questions, and I'm asking questions. And I used to be famous for going to the microphone at live events. And I remember this one live event. It was 4 days long. And by the fourth day, it was a big room, and there were three microphones, one on the left, one in the middle, one on the right. And by the end, by the fourth day, there was Arjun's mic, and then mic number two and mic number three. And they would, you know, I would ask a question, and then they go to the second mic, and then go to the third mic, and then they come back to me, and then go to the next person online at the second mic, and the next person online on the third mic, and then they come back to me, because they knew I was never going to miss a chance to ask questions. Now, today, I have a $10 million business with 35 employees who make my life much, much easier than it used to be when I was trying to do everything myself and struggling. And I am telling everyone that this life that I get to enjoy is in large part an effect of the fact that I took advantage of these kinds of opportunities. And if you are going around telling yourself that you're really serious about building a successful law firm and you don't take advantage of these kinds of opportunities, then I have to question either your judgment or your commitment. And since I know this stuff works, I have to question your commitment. Scott, you want to go to the first question, or you want to read the first question?
Actually, let's go to the first question, and I want to make sure that I don't ask somebody's question who's actually going to come out, who's already in the queue. So I'll save my questions to the very end, and we'll give everybody a chance who's in the queue. So, Carrie, we are ready for our first question. Will you bring them on and just give us their first name? And then when you come on the line, go ahead and ask your question to Arjun, and we'll go from there.
Okay, sure. First question is going to come from Lena. Lena, your line is open.
Yes, hi. How soon do I need to hire, and whom do I hire? As of today, I earn $270,000, so annually it's going to be over $300,000. And I'm at this point, I'm not sure, and I'm actively working on policies and procedures and updating them, but who do I hire, and how many people would I need, and who? So that's kind of
okay.
The question.
So, Lena, first of all, congratulations, and for all the shit I just finished giving everyone who misses out on the opportunity to be on these calls and ask these questions, I should give 10 times more compliment and praise and congratulations to people like yourself, Lena, who like myself, make our success a priority and demonstrate that success is a priority by where and how we show up. So let me just begin by saying congratulations.
Arjun, let me just also say, this is Lena's very first coaching call with us. Lena's a brand new member and has made it a point to be here as well. So I figured I would throw that in there. Not only is she on this call and not only is she asking a question, but she's a brand new member taking this seriously. So Lena, you are to be congratulated. Just wanted to throw that in there as well.
Well, good for you. Okay, so Lena, let me ask you a few questions, okay?
Yes.
When you say you earned $270,000 and you're on track to earn $300,000 this year, do you mean gross or do you mean net?
Gross.
Gross. Okay. So $300,000 gross. And out of $300,000 gross this year, assuming that you don't hire anyone, assuming you don't make any other investments, I'm going to guesstimate that – what is your practice area?
Tustin Estates.
I'm going to guesstimate that you're going to take out around $175,000 between income and other benefits you run through the business?
Income and potentially taxes. Yes, this is a little bit of a taxes side, a little bit of unknown, but yes, at least half of the $300,000 is going to be sort of income, net income.
So what I'm trying to say is that your income from the firm, your total owner benefits. And when I say total owner benefits, what I mean is your W-2 income, which is the salary. First off, let me ask you, do you have yourself on W-2 salary for the firm? Does the firm pay you
a paycheck every two weeks? I do not.
Okay. Would you please put yourself on payroll?
Okay.
No, I'm really serious. You will make more money. Your business will run better. Your life will be better. Everything will be better if you will put yourself on payroll.
Okay, will do.
Okay, do not pay yourself last. Do not settle for getting paid last. You must get paid first.
Okay.
Would anyone else work for your firm and wait to see if they get paid to the end of the month after everyone else gets paid? Is there any other person on the planet who has, you know, who isn't, like, related to you who would ever put up with that kind of shit?
No, no, absolutely not.
Okay. So what does it tell the world when you respect yourself less than you respect anyone else?
So, yes, I do pay some. I don't have an S corp, so I don't pay myself first. I contribute as much as I can to my solo 401k, so $50,000 at least this year. I did some distributions, but it's going to be more than $150,000 that's available, sort of either to be paid or total, or, you know, reinvested back into the business.
Okay. The point that I'm trying to make is, you may not realize this right now. You might, but a lot of people don't realize right now. I get asked the question you ask me a lot. You know, when should I hire someone? And people are usually surprised that my first response is usually, do you have yourself on salary? Do you have yourself on payroll? And if you don't have yourself on payroll, it's going to be very complicated to hire someone else and to make a decision to hire somebody else. It's going to become much more scary to hire someone else if you don't have yourself on payroll. Because emotionally, here's how it works. And I just say this having had the experience of doing it myself the wrong way and having worked with thousands of people who used to do it the wrong way and they do it the right way, and they say, you know, almost without any exception, that life got better when they put themselves on payroll. Because right now, you're basically taking whatever the scraps that are left over, right?
Yep, it looks like.
Well, that's exactly how it is. If you don't have yourself on payroll, you're taking the scraps that are left over. And now someone comes along, someone like me comes along and says, you should hire blah, blah, blah to help you with these different things. And emotionally, the way that it looks, and it's actually how it really looks, because how it really is, it looks like, wait a second, that means there are going to be fewer scraps left over for me, and it's very, very scary, and you start to see the employees as your competition for the scraps as opposed to an investment so you don't have to keep living on scraps. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. Number two, if you have yourself on payroll and you pay and the firm pays you every other week along with everyone else, no matter what, without exception, you know, you will always find a way to make payroll for other people. People, you know, owners of businesses will always find a way to make payroll for other people. And if you just blend your own payroll right into everyone else's payroll, as you're going along finding a way to hit that number every month to make payroll, quote unquote, make payroll, you get paid. And so everyone else almost like protects you and guarantees that you're going to pay yourself because you're not going to miss payroll, because missing payroll for one person means missing payroll for everyone. Does that make sense?
Yes.
All right. Next, when you are making payroll and when you are getting paid every 2 weeks and the money is just electronically hitting your account, just like if you had a job working for someone else, it allows you to make better decisions. You're going to think more clearly. You're going to be less emotional. You might have cash flow problems in the business, but at least you've protected your household from having cash flow problems also. You still with me?
Yes, yes. I'm just taking
notes.
And
I'll give you an example. I'm sorry?
I'm just taking notes, yes, but I agree.
Okay. And I'll give you an example. Tomorrow, I am meeting with our CFO and our in-house accountant We have a full-time in-house CFO, and we have a full-time in-house controller, accountant, management accountant, controller, same difference. And we are going to be meeting to talk about some cash crunches in how to manage a small law firm. We will gross $10 million this year. We're grossing almost $1 million a month at this point. And at the end of next month, so 6 weeks from now, because we look at our numbers, we know we're going to have a cash crunch because we've made a lot of investments for the future, because we made a lot of we strategically spent some money this year for tax planning purposes. We hired a bunch of new staff. We did a bunch of things that I'm very confident will be the right decision to make, but it's putting us into a cash crunch 6 weeks from now. You with me?
Yes.
And by the way, I'm not embarrassed to tell you, it's like a $200,000 cash crunch. In other words, we are looking 6 weeks ahead and seeing that we're going to come up around $200,000 short of what we need to cover our expenses 6 weeks from now, the week coming up 6 weeks from now. Well, the reason that I'm able to think clearly about this, the reason I'm able to bring some objectivity to this, the reason that I'm able to search and discover the solution, and in fact, I'm confident that when we meet tomorrow to dig into this, there will actually be an opportunity. The reason that I'm able to think clearly instead of losing my mind is because I'm still getting paid. You follow what I'm saying?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
My mortgage still gets paid. My car is still getting paid for by the company. I'm still going to be able to pay my son's college, private school, not college, holy crap, he's 3 years old, his private school tuition. I'm still going to be able to pay his tuition next month. I'm still going to be able to pay the nanny next month. I'm still going to be able to pay my house manager next month. I'm not telling my wife we have to cancel our vacation for next month because of the cash crunch in the business, because our personal household economy is protected and somewhat insulated from the business. And that allows me to go to work with my head screwed on straight, as opposed to going to work like a deranged lunatic running from fear. Does this all make sense?
Yes, thank you.
So it's really important that you put yourself on payroll. And I don't care if you put yourself on a $100,000 payroll or a $50,000 payroll or whatever you can afford right now, but you put yourself on payroll.
Okay, will do.
That also helps you make smarter decisions, and the exercise of determining how much you need to pay yourself will help answer the question that you actually asked me, which we're going to get to. This is all part of my answer to your question. But it's a longer answer. It's not just like a simple answer. You know, I know there's a lot of people giving a lot of business advice off of freaking Twitter with 140 characters, but this requires a longer discussion. And I'm respecting you to give you the full answer, not just a soundbite answer. Got it?
Yes.
Okay. So the next thing you do is you have to ask the question, now that I've made the decision to put myself on payroll, which everyone listening to this should have yourselves on payroll. Now that you've made the decision to put yourself on payroll, the question is how much? And the answer is what is a normalized salary? In other words, how much would we have to pay someone else to do the jobs, plural, that you are doing for the firm? Do you understand the issue or the question?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so let's take 100% of your time. Approximately what percentage of your time, if you draw a circle in front of you, take out a piece of paper and just draw a circle in front of you like a pie chart, all right? What percentage of that circle, what percentage of your time do you actually practice law?
Probably
as opposed
50%.
To all the other things you do for the business. I'm sorry?
Probably 50% health.
50%. So I'm going to draw a line straight down the middle of the circle. 50% is practicing law. 50% is everything else. right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Now, of the 50% that you practice law, how much of that 50% is senior associate time, and how much of that is junior associate time? In other words, how much of that time, how much of that 50% could be done by a junior person as opposed to what is required a more senior experience?
Probably 70% by the junior associates and 30% by senior.
Okay, so 70% of 50% is, I got to open a calculator on my phone, I'm sorry. So 50% times 0.70 is 35%. So 35% of the whole is senior. 35% is senior associate. I'm sorry, is junior associate. 35% is junior associate. And 50 times 0.30 and 15%. Is junior associate. 15% is senior associate. You following what I'm doing here?
Yes.
Okay. If anyone has any questions about how I'm doing this, you can get on the forum and ask for follow-up. This is critical. This is critical. I hope everyone's listening to this. If you don't know how to do this, you do not know how to get out of the box you are stuck in. This is critical. It's very simple, but it's a little confusing the first time you do it. So, Lena, 35% of your total time is doing the job of a junior associate. 15% of your time is doing the job of a senior associate. And together, that accounts for roughly half of your time.
Mm-hmm.
Is that about right?
Yes.
All right. Now, the other half of your time, how much of that is spent marketing? How much of that is spent on sales? How much of that is spent doing secretarial work? Account for the rest of that time for me, just roughly. For right now, you know, abouts are good enough, and it doesn't even have to add up to 100% for purposes of this conversation. Obviously, in reality, it does, but don't worry about that.
Okay. About half of that, this 50% is probably marketing and networking, and the rest is sort of administering the law firm, doing some secretarial work, not always. I do have a part-time person.
Okay, well, 25, so if 25% is marketing, we'll just, for purposes of this conversation, we'll say marketing and sales as if they're the same thing, even though you know they're not, right?
Yes.
Okay, marketing is marketing, sales is sales, they're not the same thing. But for purposes of this conversation, we'll just stick them together and say 25% of the total is marketing and sales. And then the other 25% of the time, administrative and paralegal work and secretarial work are not the same thing. So of the 25% remaining, how much is real administrative work and how much of it is paralegal or legal secretary work?
Probably half is a paralegal, half is administrative.
Okay, so we're just going to say 12.5% admin and 12.5% paralegal. Paralegal slash legal secretary. So I've been drawing this circle while we're talking, and I just drew a circle. The circle represents 100% of your time. 35% of your time is junior associate. 15% of your time is senior associate. 25% of your time is marketing and sales. 12.5% is admin, and 12.5% is paralegal. And if I've done this right, that should add up to 100%.
Yep,
you with
that's
me?
Correct. Yes.
Okay. Now, how much would it cost us to hire a full-time senior associate to do trust and estates work in your local market?
Probably $100,000 or more.
Okay. Let's just say $100,000. Let's say $125,000. Are you reasonably comfortable you could hire a senior
yes.
associate for $125,000 a month? $125,000 a year in your market?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so since 35% of your time is senior associate, 15% of your time as senior associate. We take $125,000 times 0.15, and $18,750 is what it costs to replace you showing up as a senior associate 15% of the time. So it's like the same thing as you hired a senior associate, and the senior associate said to you, listen, I appreciate you're willing to pay me $125,000 a year to show up full time, but if I only decide to show up 15% of the time, part-time, what would you pay me? And your answer would be, I'd pay you 15% of $125,000 or $18,000 a year. You with me?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. So what would it cost to hire a good junior associate in your market?
60 to 80.
Let's say $80,000. $80,000 times 0.35, because this $80,000 junior associate is only working 30% of the time. So we're going to pay that person $28,000 a year. You with me?
Yes.
All right. What would it cost to hire a really good legal secretary or paralegal in your market?
$35,000, $45,000.
Let's say 50. Would you be real happy with a $50,000 legal secretary / paralegal?
Yes.
Okay. So $50,000 times 0.125, 12%, is $6,250 a year. We would pay a $50,000 paralegal if he or she only worked for 12.5% of the time. We would pay that person 12.5% of $50,000, which is $6,250. You with me?
Yes.
And let's say we hire a $50,000 admin person who works 12.5% of the time, and that would be another $6,250. And then how much would we pay a really good marketing and salesperson in your local market if they work full-time?
I am not sure, but probably between 45 and 60.
Let's say $100,000, because people underestimate the value of marketing and salespeople, because without marketing and sales, the rest of it is really not necessary, is it?
Correct.
So let's say $100,000 for the marketing and salesperson, but that person is only working 25% of the time, so that's $25,000. So if we were to calculate what you're doing for the firm, we would pay you $18,750 for working 15% as a senior associate. We would pay you $28,000 for working 35% as a junior associate. We would pay you $6,250 for working 12.5% as a $50,000 paralegal. We would pay you $6,250 for working 12.5% as a $50,000 administrative person. And we would pay you $25,000 for working 25% as a $100,000 marketing sales professional. Are you with me?
Yes.
So we take $18,750 plus $28,000 plus $6,250 plus $6,250 plus $25,000, and we would now say that you are contributing $84,250 a year to the firm. In other words, if you got hit by a bus and the business had to hire third-party professionals to do the jobs you're doing, we would have to pay them $84,250 because we would have to hire a senior associate for 15% of their time and a junior associate part-time for 35% of their time. And obviously, this isn't exactly perfect because it's not like you're going to be able to hire a paralegal for 12.5% of their time. But the idea is, your normalized salary is around $85,000 a year.
Okay. Wow, you make it so easy. You make it so easy.
I've done this once or twice. so take $84,000, call it $85,000, divided by 26 weeks, and so you should put yourself on payroll for $3,269 a week, or every other week. So you know, basically $6,500 a month.
Okay.
Now, if you knew today in the month of October that in January your household income is going to be $6,500 as W-2 salary from your firm, would that bring some peace of mind? Would that bring some sanity into your life?
Absolutely.
Okay. And from that place, we can now have a rational conversation about who to hire, when to hire them, how much to pay them, and all of that. Make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So from what I can tell, it seems like we said that the paralegal is $50,000 a year. The admin is $50,000 a year. And you're spending 12.5% of your time doing the work of a $50,000 a year person.
Yes.
You're not a $50,000 a year person, are you?
Okay. Correct.
I mean, you're at least a $125,000 a year person. You're probably more like a $250,000 a year person. But you're a $200,000 a year person who's working as a $50,000 a year person 12.5% of your time. Does that make a lot of sense?
It does, yes.
No, I'm asking, does it make a lot of sense to do that?
Oh, no. No, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't. So now you ask me, which position should you hire first? And my answer is, you should fire yourself as a legal secretary paralegal immediately and as soon as you can, because every minute that you, every hour that you work as a legal secretary or paralegal, you are experiencing what we call false economy. You think you're saving yourself money, but it's really costing you a lot of money. You get what I'm saying?
Yes, absolutely.
Let me put this in even more direct terms that is going to hurt the feelings of a lot of lawyers listening to this and, you know, probably offend a few people. If they have any morality whatsoever, if you have any ethics, if you have any level of professionalism, the following should really punch you in the gut. If you're a unethical, unprofessional piece of shit, then this won't faze you at all. But I trust that this is going to affect you. So are you bracing yourself?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. If you were billing by the hour, and you don't bill by the hour for the most part, correct?
I do some. Probate and guardianship,
okay.
I do.
Okay. How much do you bill out the senior associate for? You have a $125,000 a year senior associate. What do you think is a reasonable rate to bill that person out at?
I am not sure. I bill for my time. I recently raised my price of $300 an hour, but
okay.
I would not.
So let's just say for a senior associate, we should bill $300 an hour. Yes?
Yep, sounds about right.
Okay. How much should we then bill for a junior associate? Less than $300 an hour, don't you think?
Absolutely.
Okay, how much should we bill for a junior associate? Let's say $200 an hour?
Yep, for very beginning junior, yep, $200. Sounds right.
$200 an hour. All right, how much should we bill for a paralegal?
I currently bill
$135 an hour. All right. Now, when you are doing the job of a paralegal, what should you ethically bill the client for?
$135.
That's right. Now, if you're capable of earning $300 an hour and you're doing the job and you're working for only and you're billing only $135 an hour, $300 minus $135 means for every hour that you work as a paralegal, you basically just wasted $165.
Okay.
So let me ask you, what's the first position you should replace yourself?
Legal secretary / paralegal.
Legal secretary. Yeah, exactly. Because for every hour that you, quote-unquote, save yourself money doing the job of a legal secretary slash paralegal yourself, you're actually costing yourself $165 an hour.
Okay.
Because you could be doing the job of a senior associate making $300 an hour. Or, you get what I'm saying?
Yes.
All right. So then the question now comes that everyone always asks. I've had this conversation with like 1,000 lawyers. Well, yeah, that'd be great if I had enough work to keep my junior associate and my senior associate busy, but I don't. Which then answers the next question is, what should you be doing with this time that you free up by hiring a paralegal? And the answer is, do more marketing, do more sales.
Okay. This would be actually my next question. What if I don't have enough work for them? But yes, if I have more time, I will spend that time marketing.
Do more marketing, do more sales. Because every hour that you spend doing the job of a paralegal, you're costing yourself $165 in opportunity cost, and you're costing yourself even more than that in opportunity cost that you could be doing marketing and sales. Because let's say on a 45-hour week, 45 hours a week times 0.125, it's roughly 6 hours that you spend doing the job of a paralegal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so in those 6 hours that you spend doing the job of a paralegal that you tell yourself you're saving money, you take six times $165, you really cost yourself $900 in opportunity cost. And what's worse, if I gave you 6 hours and for almost an entire day, once a week, you could do nothing but marketing, 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 sales, 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 sales. Couldn't you find a few extra hours a week of productive work that you could bring in?
I think so.
I know you could. You could just pick up the phone and call all of your former clients. If 6 hours a week you did nothing but call all of your former clients to see how they're doing, don't you think you could get one or two referrals out of that?
Potentially. I don't know if I would feel comfortable.
You wouldn't feel comfortable calling them and saying, I actually give a shit about you, even though the ink is dry. I'm not like every other fucking lawyer who forgot your name the minute the check cleared. I actually still care about you, and I want to see how you're doing. You wouldn't feel comfortable having that conversation?
I mean, I could force myself to do that. Yes, absolutely. But it would be unusual. But I guess
it would be unusual for you to call a former client and say, hello, remember me? I'm the person who did your estate plan. I'm the person that you shared your deepest, darkest fears and concerns, and I helped you plan the future of your life and helped you make important decisions about your family. And I'm calling to let you know I still care about you, and I want to see how you're doing.
Oh, yes. I potentially could have gotten more clients like that, additional work.
What part of that conversation is uncomfortable for you?
It just kind of sounds strange. Clients would feel to me and maybe to the former clients because they would be kind of surprised to hear from me.
Right. They'd be surprised that a lawyer actually gives a shit about them. They'd be surprised that for once they ran into a lawyer who isn't a fucking asshole. They'd be surprised that a lawyer who, even though the case is closed, even though the check is cleared, even though there's nothing to do on the case, they'd be surprised that a lawyer actually has the decency and the humanity to check back with them and say, I still care about you. You're right, they would be surprised, but they'd be pleasantly surprised. Wouldn't you be pleasantly surprised if a lawyer called you months or years after the case was over to say, hey, listen, Lena, I care about you. How you doing?
Yep. I guess I would be pleasantly surprised.
I don't know your last name. Don't tell me your last name. I want you to feel comfortable being anonymous here. But have you ever had, like, any kind of medical procedure, or have you ever had a lawyer represent you in a emotional situation?
No.
You've never had a medical procedure?
but not that the lawyer would represent me.
Have you ever had a medical procedure?
Oh, medical procedure? Yes, sure. Like LASIK.
Okay. Would you be offended or impressed if your LASIK doctor called you a year later to say, hi, listen, I just like to make it a practice to call all of my patients about a year after the surgery is over. Just, you know, I like to call on the one-year anniversary around there to just see how you're doing, if you have any questions, if you're happy with the results, you know, and just find out how your life is now that you've had the surgery.
Yeah, I would have been very surprised.
Pleasantly surprised or unpleasantly surprised?
Pleasantly.
Okay. When you had your LASIK surgery, did your doctor have a conversation with you before you had the LASIK surgery about what your hopes and dreams and goals and plans were and why you were getting the LASIK surgery and all the ways you were hoping it was going to make your life better?
Yes.
Would it be nice if the doctor called you and actually remembered and had some notes to talk about some of those hopes and dreams? Hey, Lena, a year ago when we had the LASIK surgery, you mentioned to me that one of the things you were hoping to do as a result of getting the LASIK surgery is you were hoping to learn to play the harmonica and that, you know, getting the LASIK surgery would help you play the harmonica. Did you ever take those harmonica lessons?
Mm-hmm. I guess it would be a little bit strange. I think it would be a little bit strange because that's not a common practice.
You think it's strange if the doctor calls you and actually demonstrates that he actually cares about you and hasn't forgotten about you?
I've never had it before. It would have been different as the first doctor who would have called me.
The question is, would it be pleasantly strange or unpleasantly strange?
A little bit of both.
Okay. You need to get over yourself. And you need to stop hanging around with a bunch of loser lawyers who are broke and complain. No, I'm really serious. I can already tell everyone you hang around with. I can already tell that almost most of the lawyers you hang around with are broke, they're struggling, they're complaining about the economy, and they're probably throwing money at every marketing scam that comes down the pipe. Do you know any lawyers? Do you hang around with any lawyers who have $500,000 or $1 million law firm?
Lawyers usually don't discuss how much are they making. They make it sound that like they're doing very well, but how well, I have no idea.
Okay.
So it's just kind of my experience.
If you ever get an opportunity, if Scott ever gives you an opportunity to attend any of our live quarterly meetings, you will be around a room of 400 lawyers, 340 lawyers, who all are open and honest about everything going on in their business. They celebrate each other's success. And the most successful lawyers will tell you that they regularly make what we call gas calls, give a shit calls, calls to their former clients to let them know, even though your case is over, I still give a shit about you.
Yep.
Don't you think your clients would like to know that even though the case is over, you still give a shit about them?
Absolutely.
By the way, what happens the minute the estate plan is – the minute the ink dries on the estate plan, what begins happening to that estate plan? You do trust and estates. What happens the minute the estate plan, the ink dries on the estate plan?
Not sure. I usually tell them to revisit it every year on their own and every 3 to 5 years to let the lawyer review just to make sure that it complies with the current law.
And do you think that any of your clients ever follow that advice?
Probably not. But I used to work for somebody who would be calling, not himself, but he would have a very good salesperson call all his clients and try to schedule complimentary consultations, you know, 3 to 5 years later. And he was very successful at that.
And you know what would work even better than 3 to 5 years is if you call them every year.
Okay.
So I'm asking you a question. What happens to every estate plan the minute the ink dries? What begins happening to that estate plan the minute the ink dries? You're an estate planning attorney. You know the answer to this.
Okay. I guess I'm just not sure.
The estate plan becomes less and less relevant by the minute.
Okay. Okay. I thought about
Doesn't it
for a second. Yep. Yes.
Right? Because people change their age, people change their health, people change their marital status, people, their kids get older, they buy property, they sell property, they have things happening in their life, they start businesses, they close businesses, they move, they do different things, their relationships change. And meanwhile, you don't give a shit about any of them because you don't care enough to call them, even though you know better.
Absolutely.
You're an estate planning attorney. You know this. They don't know this. They didn't go to law school. They did not focus on estate trust and estate law. They don't understand or appreciate just how much their estate plan is becoming less and less relevant by the minute as their life goes on and as they make changes in their life. You know this, but you leave it to them to figure it out for themselves. A year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years down the line after they haven't heard from you, but you gave them that very technically correct advice of don't forget to check your estate plan every year because of blah, 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 blah. And 3 years when they need their estate plan because some tragedy befalls their life, but they have not updated their estate plan. But meanwhile, they bought some property, they sold some property, they opened a business, they closed the business, they took out credit, they put some money in savings. They had a new grandchild, and their estate plan is no longer really the same estate plan. Their estate is no longer the same estate that it was 3 years ago or 5 years ago, and now they die, and they find out the hard way after they die, or their heirs find out the hard way after they die that their estate plan is no longer relevant. Do you think that any of them really appreciate the fact that you didn't contact grandma or grandpa for the last 3 to 5 years, or do they think you're all an ass, or do they all think you're an asshole?
I guess if they could benefit from it, yes, they would absolutely appreciate.
I know that I'm speaking harshly to you, Lena. I'm speaking harshly to you because I have a very short period of time to get a really important point across to you. And the point that I'm trying to get across to you is that you're hiding out behind the way most lawyers run their business, and the way most lawyers run their business is garbage. They do not demonstrate by their actions that they give a crap about their clients. They demonstrate by their actions that they don't give a crap about their clients because they don't bother to check in with them afterwards. After you got your LASIK surgery, did anyone check in with you a day later, a week later, a month later to see how you were recovering, how you were doing?
No, I had a couple of scheduled consultations to check right after, but no, not after that.
But you did at least have a few scheduled consultations, right?
Yes, yes, within the first week.
How would you have felt? How would you have felt if the doctor came, saw you at post-op, and said, "Okay, your LASIK surgery is over. Good luck. You should check with the doctor every once in a while. Goodbye. You're never going to hear from us again." How would you have felt?
Concerned. And the doctor didn't really care about me or my particular problem.
Okay. And how would you have felt if the doctor said, on the other hand, by comparison, if the doctor said, "Listen, your surgery went well. We're going to let you go home. We're going to check back with you tomorrow to see how you're doing. Then we're going to have an appointment for a week from now. Then we're going to have another appointment for a month from now. Then we're going to have another appointment for 4 months, for 6 months from now. And then we're going to have an annual checkup just to see how you're doing because I want to make sure that everything's going just right for you." How would you have felt then?
Wonderfully.
Can you see the correlate? Can you see the analogy? Can you see the connection I'm making between the LASIK surgery and the estate plan?
Yes, absolutely.
So now you want to know where you go to get more business. What do you think is going to happen when you check in with the doctor a year later?
Well, if the doctor would have called me, I would have felt very special and that they cared. And potentially somebody else would have been asking my opinion about the LASIK, a good LASIK doctor. The name definitely would have come up.
Right. Especially if the doctor engineered it so that part of the checkup with you in 6 months and part of the checkup with you in a year, you know, you know, ask some questions that were designed to kind of get your thinking along those lines, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like one of the questions the doctor could have asked in 6 months is, so how has your life changed since you got the LASIK surgery? And you would have said, oh, I started playing tennis again. Oh, I started doing crochet again. Oh, I started, you know, to do whatever again. And, you know, the doctor could have said, oh, have any of your friends or family commented on anything going, you know, on anything because you now have a LASIK? And these questions that the doctor would have been asking would have caused you to think, oh, yeah, you know what? I forgot. I got to make this referral.
Absolutely.
See how much business is right there at your fingertips with all your former clients that you've never tapped into?
Absolutely.
Your average estate plan is what, $5,000?
Actually less. For a basic estate planning documents, it's probably $1,800, $2,000 for a couple. And visit trust, probably $4,500 for a couple.
My point being, you've got like 100 clients a year or 50 clients a year. The last 3 years, you've got 150 phone calls you could make. And out of 150 phone calls you could make for people from the last 3 or 4 years, you could probably raise another $150,000 or $200,000 of new business.
Yep, good point.
But instead, you're fucking around doing paralegal work.
Okay, yes.
Are you getting my point?
Yes.
Good. Fire your paralegal. Meaning fire yourself as a paralegal. Hire a paralegal, pick up the phone, start calling your former clients, and you'll have more than enough business to keep your paralegal, your junior associate, and your senior associate busy.
Okay.
You know what we call it when we have a rule whereby every time we close an estate plan or every time we do a trust or a probate, we systematically call the person back a month later, 3 months later, a year later, every single person? That's called a system.
Mm-hmm.
You put that system together. You run that system yourself for, 6 months to prove that it works, test it, tweak it, improve it, and then you can hire someone else to run the system for you.
Okay.
Now you've got a marketing system. Now you've got a marketing system that gets done by someone other than you, and now you're someone else other than you is doing the paralegal work, and next thing you know, you hire someone else as the junior associate, and next thing you know, we've just taken 25, 35, that's 55, 60. We've now taken 70% of your hours off your plate and you're making more money. So you're making more money and you got 70% of your time being done by other people and you're making more money.
Yep.
All because of systems.
Okay. I'll do that.
Please. Please, please, please. And I know I'm being aggressive in this call. It's just that we have a very short amount of time, and I have to get a lot through to you in a very short time. If we were at a workshop, if you were at a live quarterly meeting, and we had more time, I would be able to have walked you through this, and you would have reached a lot of these conclusions on your own. But I had to sort of accelerate the process, and I appreciate you being a good sport. So thank you for that.
Okay. Yes. Thank you very much, Arjun.
You're welcome.
Lena, thank you.
Scott, do we have time for anyone else?
Yeah, we've got two more questions in the queue. So I'm going to invite Carrie to come on the line, and let's see if we can hammer through these next two questions as quickly as possible. So, Carrie, bring our next question, please.
Okay, our next question is going to come from Claudia. One moment. Claudia, your line is open.
Hello.
Hi, Claudia.
Hey, Claudia, how are you?
Good, and you. Thank you, and thank you, Lena, for I learned a lot from the previous caller. My question is, I know you talked about that there are 7 components of a business, and my question is, how do you know, and they have to all be balanced, but how do you know which one to focus on? Because right now I feel like they're all in balance, and I'm trying to focus on which one, because I started, I was doing marketing and I got a lot of cases, but then I felt that I was being overwhelmed with the work, so I stopped the marketing. But now I'm realizing, not yet, but probably a couple of months, I will be running out of work. But then I don't want to be on the, turn the marketing off, turn it on, off and on. And then I just feel I'm just like jumping in between the hoops, and I'm not really stable, or no sanity, I guess, like you call it.
Right. So just to refresh everyone's recollection, there's seven main parts of every successful law firm, and there's seven main parts of every unsuccessful law firm, and they're all the same seven main parts. The difference between a successful law firm and a law firm that struggles and makes the owner crazy, lack of sanity, is the degree to which these seven main parts get systematized. And what you're beginning to experience is what happens when you don't systematize the seven main parts of your law firm, and you turn them on and you turn them off, and you turn them on and you turn them off, and you turn them on and you turn them off, and it starts to set up this wave, a cascade through your business. It's like a cascade of insanity through your business. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah.
All right, so the seven main parts, just to refresh everyone's recollection, is marketing. Marketing is everything you do to bring prospective clients to the door. Sales. Sales is everything you do to convert the prospective client into paying clients. Production. Production is how the work gets done. Marketing is going to market solutions. Sales is going to sell services and sell solutions. And now production kicks in to actually do the work that got sold. People. That's job descriptions, that's training of the receptionist, the secretary, the paralegal, the associate, the rainmaker, the manager, the owner, the bookkeeper, the CEO, the COO, the CFO, you know, all the positions of the firm. Physical plant. Physical plant is the physical space, the office, even if it's a home office, it's still an office, the furniture, the fixtures, the equipment, the technology. And a big part of the physical plant, the most valuable part of the physical plant, are the systems, the documented systems for how things work, the policies plus the procedures. Then there's the financial controls. Every month we should be getting from our bookkeeper a written 12-month forward-looking revised budget. We should be getting a budget variance report. We should be getting a cash flow projection. We should be getting an accounts receivables report. We should be getting a work-in-process report. And we should be like a pipeline of work that's going through that's not ready to be billed yet, so we can predict cash flow. And we should be getting a cash position. How much do we have in the operating account? How much do we have in the trust account? And then, of course, the last of the seven main parts are your goals, your financial goals, your personal goals, and your professional goals. Okay, so there's a refresher, everyone, on the seven main parts of a law firm. Now, your question is, remind me your question. It was when to do what first?
Yes, I don't know on which one to focus on if I feel that there are somewhat imbalance.
Okay, well,
mostly the marketing and the work.
I don't think they're in balance based on what you said. Based on what you said, it sounds like they're very much not in balance. Because you said you turned the marketing on for a little while and you got overwhelmed with work. If they were in balance, then you wouldn't get overwhelmed with work. Think of it like a garden hose.
Mm-hmm.
Think of it like a garden hose.
Okay.
If the garden hose is, let's say, you know, 2 inches, a 2-inch garden hose, when the water is coming out the garden hose kind of like at a modest amount, like a little bit of water coming in, I mean, a little bit, like the amount of water going in one end of the garden hose, the same amount of water is coming out the other end of the garden hose, and it's a nice, easy, comfortable trickle. Right.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
But if a lot more water is coming into one end of the garden hose, what comes out the other side?
A lot of water.
A big spray, right? A big
mm-hmm.
spray. There's a lot
mm-hmm.
of pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And if you put your finger over the end of a garden hose, you know that's where you create that spray, because you're restricting the amount of water that can come out of it. And so the pressure pushes the water harder and builds up back pressure and backflow. You with me?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So what you just told me is actually the exact opposite of all of the seven main parts are in alignment. because what you told me is that the minute you turned on your marketing, production got overwhelmed. And you had so much so that you had to turn off your marketing.
Correct. Yes, they're not in balance.
I apologize. I misunderstood. I thought you said that you thought they were in balance.
No, they're not. That I'm 100% sure of. They're not.
I apologize. I thought I heard you say the opposite of that.
Yeah.
Good. So you recognize they're not in balance. So your question is how you get them in balance, right?
Because I know I can't tackle all seven at the same time. And
First question I have for you is, what is your practice area?
I'm a tax attorney. I do tax. I do both planning and when you get in trouble with the IRS.
Got it. Okay. We've got several members who do the same thing. I'm very familiar with that practice area. Mm-hmm. All right. And what were your what are your revenues going to be this year, 2018?
I'm on track probably for 200. Growth.
Okay. And what are your financial goals for next year? How much does it cost to live the way you want to live next year? Net income. How much net income do you have to have next year to live the way you want to live?
I will want to, for next year, I want to be able to double that, my growth.
Okay, who cares about gross? I don't care about gross. I only care about net. How much does it cost to live the way you want to live next year?
Okay, I guess next year I want to be able to always get my salary $10,000 every month.
Okay, so next year your goal is to take $120,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and $120,000 a year is roughly $360,000 a year gross.
But I
so roughly double
that.
What you're roughly double what you're grossing now.
Oh, okay.
Is that about right?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
But
so,
just for reference, like last year my gross was 100. So I really want to build a business.
Okay. I hear you.
Okay.
I hear your words, and I also hear the tone of your voice, which makes me really believe that you're sincere. From year one to year two, you grew your business by 100%, and from year two to year three, you need to grow your business by 100% again. Correct?
I want to. Yes.
Okay. So, do you know how much the average small law firm grows per year in this country?
I think like less than 10%.
It's like 5%. It's like
5%. But I don't want to be the average. I want to have a business. I have a job right now. But if I don't work, I don't make money. So I want a business.
I completely understand you, and I believe you. And I'm trying to illustrate. I'm trying to make a point.
Okay, sorry. I'll listen.
No, it's okay. It's okay. The average small law firm in this country grows by only 5%.
Mm-hmm.
You go to most bar association meetings and you talk to most lawyers and you ask them about what they're doing, what they're not doing, what's normal, what's not normal, what's acceptable, what's not acceptable. And most of the advice they give you is going to be coming from a person who thinks it's okay to grow their business by 5%. Do you know what we have to do with most of the advice that most lawyers are giving you? If you want to grow your business by 100%?
Ignore it.
Exactly. If you want to have what the average person has, do what the average person does. If you want to have what the average person does not have, you better stop doing what the average person does. Okay. So if you want to grow your business by 100% in the next 12 months, it's 100% possible. It's a lot of fun. Very, very, very feasible. But you're going to have to get comfortable with a couple of ideas. And this is more a mental game than anything else. The reason why most lawyers don't grow their businesses by 100% per year, and the reason why most of our members at How to Manage a Small Law Firm do, is because we focus on the mental game first. So the first part of the mental game is you have to get comfortable ignoring most of what most of the other lawyers around you are doing. Like,
okay.
Not emulating them, not paying attention to them. Before you even take advice from anyone, you ask them, how much did you grow your business? And if they say 5% or 10%, it's like turn around, walk away, don't listen to another word they say. Unless you listen to them and then take notes of what they say and say, what is the exact opposite of that?
Okay.
You ever see that Seinfeld episode where George did opposite day?
No, I didn't see it.
Okay. Do you ever watch Seinfeld?
Yes.
Okay. You know who George is?
Yes, yes, I do.
The lovable loser on Seinfeld. So he had a day. So one day he decided to start doing the opposite of whatever came naturally for him. And all of a sudden, like, everything in his life started working. It was really funny. Met a girl, and his natural instincts would be to do this. So he said, what's the exact opposite of that? He did exactly the opposite, and she, like, went out on a date with him. He went to his boss, and his first instinct was to do this. So he said, what's the exact opposite of that? And he did the exact opposite, and he got a raise. You get the idea? So you got to, like, listen to what the average lawyer is saying and just do the exact opposite of what the average lawyer is saying and doing, and you're pretty much heading in the right direction if you do the opposite of what they're doing. So
okay.
It's a mental game. That's the first thing, is you have to get comfortable understanding that you're going to be very lonely in your local market. Where are you? Where do you live? What city?
I'm in Bethesda, Maryland, but I also have an office in Florida, Miami.
Okay. So you got to get comfortable, you know, kind of opposite of what most of the other lawyers in your market are doing, and probably doing the opposite of what most of the people in your life are doing if they're not growing their businesses really fast. And that's a mental game more than anything else. The second thing you got to get comfortable with is you got to get comfortable being uncomfortable. You get to a point where you're just comfortable being uncomfortable if you want to grow that fast.
Okay.
All right. Third, you got to kind of wrap your head around the idea that lots of other people, even though we are the minority, we are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of us, lots of other people are growing their businesses by 25%, 50%, 100% year on year on year. I don't know if you saw this year's Law Firm 500 Award. The fastest growing law firm grew 1,900% in the last 3 years. And there were lots of them over 1,000% and many, 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 many at 500%.
Okay.
And if they can do it, I promise you there's nothing extraordinary about any of these people that I have any reason to believe you don't possess also. They just wanted to do it more than most people. And they were willing to do things that most people weren't willing to do. So this is mostly a mental game. Okay?
Okay.
All right. So, number one, turn your marketing back on.
Okay.
To the extent your marketing is overwhelming your firm, and you are, then you will be in a very good position to raise your standards when it comes to the cases and the clients you will accept. So in the beginning days, when I was first building How to Manage a Small Law Firm, I needed cash, and I was willing to help anyone who would let me. And I accepted work from people who I accepted people into How to Manage a Small Law Firm who I probably should not have accepted into How to Manage a Small Law Firm because I needed the cash and I knew I could help them.
Okay.
Nowadays, by January, we're literally going to have a waiting list and we're turning people away. Well, you know, I can now be a lot more selective and can be a lot more I can be a lot more selective about who I will accept and who I will not accept into How to Manage a Small Law Firm. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So turn your marketing back on and raise your standards for the kinds of cases you'll take and raise your standards for the kind of clients you'll take and see if you can manage the demand by raising your standards. Because wouldn't it be a great thing if you turned your marketing back on and instead of taking every case that came in the door, you turn down half the cases that didn't meet your standards? Wouldn't life be better?
Yes, but then I think it's maybe the mental game that I worry, what if I won't get another client? And then I worry about making sure, because I started projecting the cash flow. So I will know that.
Why wouldn't you get another client? You just said the marketing, you turned the marketing on, and you had more business than you could handle. Did I miss the memo that the IRS sent out that said we're going to start being reasonable and fair with everyone? Did I miss that one?
No. And I guess it's like you said, I just have to be comfortable with not having 100% centered, being certain about certain things happening.
Well, but you can be 100% certain about certain things happening. One of the things you can be 100% certain about is that the IRS will continue to be unreasonable and unfair and run by people who don't even read their own rules half the time.
No, I always say they're my best marketing tool, the IRS. They make my life easier.
So my question, so you said there's, so we're talking about things you can and cannot be 100% certain about. And I'm asking, can you be 100% certain that the IRS will continue to be unreasonable?
Yes.
Okay, so we're 100% certain that the IRS will continue to create new clients for you, right? Yes?
I guess, but...
You guess? Do you have any doubt in your mind whatsoever? Do you have any doubt that the IRS is going to continue to be the way the IRS has been, at least for the next couple of years?
But just because you get somebody in the door doesn't mean that they're going to become your client.
The question is, this is your mind playing games with you and causing you to be stupid. You're not stupid, but your mind is causing you to act like you are. Break this down into its pieces. If 1 and 1 is 2, do you know that 1 and 1 is 2?
Mm-hmm.
And if 1 and 1 is 2, then what do you know 2 and 2 has to be?
4.
And 4 and 4, by the laws of the universe, therefore have to be what?
8.
And 8 and 8 by the laws of the universe must be 16, and 16 and 16 by the laws of the universe must be 32, and 32 and 32 by the laws of the universe must be 64. You've got to be able to get 64 if you add 32 and 32. There's no way around that, right?
Correct.
All because the laws of the universe, but the laws of the universe also work and say 1 and 1 is 2. But what's happening is you are afraid and unfamiliar with 64. 64 is a huge number for you, and it's a scary number for you. Oh, my God, how could I have 64? And so you're doubting the laws that get you to 64, which is why we've got to break it down to the basic fundamentals that 1 and 1 is 2. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Do you understand that 24 months from now you could have a million-dollar law firm? 36 months, let's say?
If I don't get in the way of myself.
You understand intellectually that 36 months from now, you could have a $1 million law firm. You see? You're doubting yourself.
Okay.
Do you know how simple it would be for you to have a $1 million law firm 36 months from now?
Because if I double... That would be 4 next year and the following.
And double again one more time, and you're almost at $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like the IRS is going to stop creating demand for your services,
no.
Unfortunately, for the rest
and
of
I'm
us.
And I'm a niche. I get a lot of – I'm fluent in Spanish, so that's my niche market.
Okay. So listen.
Mm-hmm.
Stop psyching yourself out. Just accept the basic building blocks. Let's just walk through this quickly together, okay?
Okay.
Are you at least very confident that the IRS will continue to create problems for people in the next couple of years?
Yes.
Okay. Are you at least very confident that the people who have IRS problems will go looking for a solution in the next couple of years?
Yes.
Are you at least very confident that the people who go looking for solutions to their IRS problems will continue to be highly, highly motivated to find solutions to those problems on account of the fact that the IRS is very scary to everyone?
Yes.
Okay. Are you at least very confident that IRS tax defense work is going to continue to be highly complex and very specialized?
Yes.
Are you at least very confident that even if everyone decided to suddenly start doing IRS tax defense work, it would take them at least a few years to learn how to do the work? It's not something you could just learn overnight.
Correct.
You went to law school. How many years ago did you go to law school?
About 15.
Okay. Do you remember in law school how many people were afraid of math?
Oh, a lot.
Are you at least very confident that most of the people coming out of law school today are still just as afraid of math as the people who came out of law school 15 years ago?
Yes.
Okay. Are you at least very confident that anyone who you went to law school with who is afraid of math probably would run away from your kind of work because they're afraid of math?
Yes.
Okay. So let's just see if we can put this all together and tell me how confident you are in being able to double your business, okay? One, the IRS is going to continue to be unfair and unreasonable, being run by people who don't even read their own rules. People who get targeted by the IRS or mistreated by the IRS are highly, highly motivated to find a solution on account of the fact that everyone's afraid of the IRS. People who have IRS problems are resourceful and will find the money to solve their IRS problems because no one wants to have their assets seized or go to jail. Most lawyers are afraid of doing that kind of work because they're afraid of math. And even if they wanted to start doing that kind of work, it takes years to develop any kind of technical proficiency. Are all these true statements?
Correct.
Okay. Well, then, what has to be true about the prospects of growing your firm if all of that is true?
That I should be able to grow my firm.
That there won't be a lack of demand for your services.
Correct.
Now, you might mismanage your firm. You might misprice your services. You might hire the wrong people, manage them badly, manage the workflow processes badly, mismanage your own finances. I mean, there's a lot of ways for you to screw this up, but it won't be from lack of demand for your services. Right?
Correct.
So you asked me what I thought you should focus on first, and what I said is first is you should turn the marketing back on.
Okay.
And to the extent that you have more demand than you can handle, what you should do is you should raise your standards for the cases you take and the clients you take, and then raise your fees.
Okay.
Right? So your current profit margin is roughly 33%, right?
Something about that.
Right. Well, if you raise your fees by 10%, that 10% is all profit, all net, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And if response to the fees being 10% higher than they are right now, half the people calling your firm say thanks but no thanks, problem solved when you said you have too much demand.
Okay.
Turn the marketing back on. Don't turn the marketing off.
Okay.
If you wanna launch the rocket to the moon, super glue the accelerator onto the floor and let's deal with the consequences of that.
Okay.
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 I told you this is scary, didn't I?
It is.
It's scary, but this is how you do it.
Okay.
Don't turn the marketing off.
Okay.
Raise the standard.
Hello?
Arjun, are you there? Claudia, I can still hear you.
Okay.
I think we may have lost Arjun for a moment. I know he's calling in on his cell phone. So we'll give him a moment. I'm thinking his battery may have gone off on his cell phone. So let me see what we can do to get him back. Give me one moment here. I'm still here. All right, so he's dialing back in. So we did lose his cell phone there. So he's calling back in. But as we're waiting on him, Claudia, what I want you to know is I know what Arjun is sharing with you is scary, but you've got us along your side. And so as okay. you take these steps, as you take these steps that Arjun is suggesting that you take, and many of you listening in, whether you're on the call now or you're listening by way of the membership site or CD or what, you know, that's one of the things that you've got. You've got this membership. You've got one another in the forum to be able to support another
sorry.
And encourage one another. Yeah, hey, Arjun, I was just telling Claudia that, you know, I know that what you were just sharing with her is scary, but
Scott?
She's got – yes.
Sorry, I got
you. Can you hear me?
Cut off and back in. Yeah, I'm back.
Okay, so I was just telling Claudia that, you know, what you were saying to her was scary, but, like, number one, she's got this membership to support her. She's got you. She's got me. She's got other members through the forum to be able to take these so that she's taking these steps that you're suggesting, that we're here along the way to encourage her, to support her, and she will make it happen. So I'll turn it back over to you. You were in the middle of a thought. I forget what it was, but glad you were able to join us back.
Yeah, sorry about that. I got cut off. So, Claudia, so keep the marketing turned on.
Okay.
Temper the demand by raising your standards. Temper the demand by raising your fees. Take the extra profit you make from raising your fees and use it to hire more staff.
Okay. Okay.
Then your marketing meets your capacity.
Got it. Okay. So that's how I start balancing things out.
Yes, do not turn the marketing on and off, on and off, on and off. Leave the marketing on, raise the standards, raise the prices, take the extra profit you make from the higher prices, take the extra free time you get from screening out the clients who are too much trouble because you raised your standards, reinvest that extra profit, reinvest that extra time to hire and train your staff.
Okay.
And look to get yourself out of the day-to-day work as quick as you can. Apply all the lessons we talked about with Lena in the previous call.
Yes, yes. Okay.
There's the short answer to your question.
Okay. And then
congratulations.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Awesome. Thank you, Claudia. Hey, Carrie, we are ready for our final question. Arjun, this will be our last question. And then we'll go into concluding our call. So, Carrie, can you bring the last question on the line, please?
Scott, are we going to raffle off a couple of spots to a live quarterly meeting?
Yeah, we can do that. I will, yes. Let me think that through on the next question about how we can raffle that off. And then I'll give instructions. Yeah, so let me, we'll make that happen.
Why don't we save that announcement for the next monthly call, and let's say that to qualify for the raffle, they have to be on the next monthly call, and during the next monthly call live, we'll give instructions for how to enter the raffle, and that way, you know, they're on the call next month, they'll follow the instructions, they'll have an opportunity to win tickets to come to the next live quarterly meeting. If they are only listening to the call pre-recorded, because they missed the live call and missed the chance to have a question answered, then I guess they're also going to miss their chance to come to the live quarterly meeting and meet hundreds and hundreds of lawyers with some of the fastest growing, most successful small law firms in the country.
Sounds like a plan. Let's do it.
And then, yeah, so we'll reward everyone who shows up for next month's call.
That sounds good. I'll make that known to everybody because I know some people weren't on the call today, so I'll be promoting that between now and our next call so that we can get as many of our members on the call and raffle it off. So it sounds good.
Excellent.
All right. Carrie, last question.
Okay, our last question is going to come from Yadi. Yadi, your line is open.
Great, thanks. Hi.
Hi, spell your name for me, please.
Yadi, it's Y-A-D-I.
Yadi, okay. Hi, Yadi.
Hi. So one of the questions I had, and I think it's kind of a little different from the previous two, but mainly I'm the one who's responsible for our policies and procedures and, you know, constantly updating them, reviewing them, improving them, et cetera. And one of the policies that slash procedures that we are currently facing at our firm that's the most frustrating is financials, specifically getting paid. An issue that we have found is that once our clients are towards the end of the retainer and through with that, we have found that it's hard to get our clients to pay. So I guess, you know, what are we doing wrong, or what are we, you know, what should we be doing to ensure that we are getting paid and clients aren't racking up, you know, $10,000, $15,000 bills?
Okay. Wow, there's a lot wrapped in there. So let me ask a couple questions to sort of unpack it, okay? First off, are you saying that once they've exhausted the money in trust, you have a hard time getting them to replenish it, and so you have to stop work? Or are you telling me that once they've exhausted everything in trust, you have a hard time getting them to replenish it, the lawyer keeps working, and now you have accounts receivables problems?
Basically, yeah. So we have
– back up. Mm-hmm. I just want to – like, is it that the client has money in the trust account? At some point, they stop replenishing the trust account. The law firm stops doing work on the file, and the case is unfinished, incomplete. But there's no accounts receivables. There's just no money left in the trust account. Or, completely different situation, trust account gets exhausted. Mm-hmm. Client won't replenish it. Mm-hmm. And law firm keeps doing work, and now we have accounts receivables. So in the first scenario, we do not have accounts receivables. In the second scenario, we do.
No, we definitely have a second scenario situation.
Got it. Okay, so you have – okay, that's one issue.
Right.
Next, you said something, and I caught it, like a red flag. You said policies / procedures.
Well, are I you, policies you, and procedures. I'm not saying they're both
okay.
the same. I just mean like
good.
Both.
Yeah, good.
And.
Just want to make sure everyone's clear that policies are not the same thing as procedures. Good.
Right.
And what is your role in the firm?
So I am their law firm administrator. So I handle a variety of things, financials being my current project right now.
How big is the firm?
It's a pretty small law firm. So it's just myself and then two other attorneys.
Okay. And what type of work?
Family law.
Family.
Uh-huh.
Got it. Okay. Are you a member of the Association of Legal Administrators?
The attorney, yes, with him, yes.
The attorney is a member of the Association of Legal Administrators, but you're not?
Oh, no, no. No, I am not officially a member with them. I've been to a few of their events, but I am not a member with them yet.
Okay. What is your background? How long have you worked for this law firm for?
Since April, so I haven't been here that long.
Okay, since April. And today is October, so May, June, July, August, September, October. So roughly 6 months.
Yeah.
And what did you do before you administered this law firm?
I was a student in college, so that's.
And what did you study in college?
Criminal justice.
What experience do you have managing any kind of a business before you took this job?
Little to none, actually, which was quite a surprise almost as to why I got hired, which I greatly appreciated, but, you know, I've definitely learned a lot and have been learning from the attorney I work for as far as the stuff, but I really haven't had a whole lot of, you know, experience doing what I'm doing now.
How much did the firm gross last year?
Last year, $190,200. I think that's the number.
That's not possible.
I'm sorry, an annually, you mean?
Yes.
The total number I have is
year.
189,000.
That's not possible.
That's the number I have from him. I mean,
it's not possible that two lawyers working anywhere close to full time, mm-hmm. even part time, could mm-hmm. gross only $189,000 in a whole year. Think about that.
Yeah, I don't know what they were doing then.
How much is that per month?
I mean, I don't know, roughly between like
$20,000 a month. And mm-hmm. what do they bill per hour?
$350.
What's $20,000 divided by $350 an hour?
It's like $60.
60 hours.
Mm-hmm.
What's 60 hours divided by 2?
30.
What's 30 divided by 4 weeks in a month?
7.5.
So basically, those lawyers have to each be billing 7 hours a week
mm-hmm.
to gross only $189,000 in a year. Do you realize how impossible that is?
Sounds pretty ridiculous. Yeah, I don't know. Like I said,
more to the point, how could they even be paying the lights?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't.
Do you understand why I'm challenging
yeah.
you on this?
Yeah, I understand because it's almost like
why
how
do you think I'm challenging
this is running. Because, I mean, we're trying to build a business, and if we're not.
Why do you think I'm challenging you on this, Yadi, who says you're a legal administrator?
So I can go ahead and totally, completely change this because there's clearly an issue. And
why do you think I'm challenging you on this, Yadi?
I mean, I don't know.
Does this make any sense to you, this information you're giving me? Does it make any sense at all that the firm could grow, that two lawyers could gross only $189,000 last year? Now they got to pay rent, they got to pay malpractice insurance, they got to pay utilities, mm-hmm. they got to pay bar dues, they got to pay they got to pay for dues and subscriptions, they got to pay for marketing, they got to pay for staff, they got to pay mm-hmm. for coffee, they got to pay for paper, they got to pay for everything. How could mm-hmm. they possibly have grossed only $189,000 last year?
Good question.
And yet you swallowed it hook, line, and sinker without even giving it a second thought, and then repeated it to me.
Yeah, well, that's kind of where the issue is with personally myself, that I'm not somebody who has a whole lot of experience with this. So learning all these numbers and what, you know, needs improvement and how to go about that has been quite my challenge personally. So I've been trying to get involved in coaching calls like these and meeting with, you know, other agencies
and
that
I'm,
kind of help
and
us.
I'm giving you some coaching, Yadi.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And I greatly appreciate it.
You don't have to have run a law firm before. You don't have to
mm-hmm.
run any kind of a business before.
Mm-hmm.
You sound like an intelligent person. You're taking it upon yourself to be on this call, which tells me that you are an inquisitive, curious person. You consider yourself to be an intelligent, curious, inquisitive person?
Very much so, yes.
Okay. The first thing I can teach you about learning to run a law firm
mm-hmm.
is question everything.
Yeah.
Never walk around. You should have a calculator with you at all times.
Mm-hmm.
And every time they tell you anything, you should do the math on it and say, wait a second, this doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I want to give you an assignment.
Okay.
I want to give you an assignment to go out for dinner tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Can you go out for dinner tonight? Do you have time?
Of course.
Okay. I want to give you an assignment to go out for dinner tonight.
Okay.
And get on the forum and report to us what you think the restaurant probably grosses in a year.
Okay.
How are you going to figure that out?
Well, first of all, look at what I paid for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the amount of people in the actual restaurant.
Count seats. Count how many chairs there are in the restaurant. Count how many tables,
okay.
how many are two tops, how many are four tops, how many are six tops, so you kind of get an idea how much is full capacity, right?
Right.
Okay,
then,
keep going.
Multiply that by my bill and then average that out to what their average bill would be.
And what else?
And then find that.
If your job depended on getting this number within 20%, would you stop there?
No.
If your job depended, if you knew that if you got this wrong, you were going to get fired, what else would you do?
Are you still specifically talking about this assignment or?
Yeah.
So then I would find what that would be weekly, monthly, yearly.
The job, the assignment is come back and tell us within 20% plus or minus how much this restaurant grosses in a year. And if you, and if you're off by more than 20%, you get fired. On the spot, you're fired.
Well, that would suck. I guess I'm kind of not following now what you're...
I'm saying to you that if you get this wrong, you're fired.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm asking you, what else would you do to figure out the right number so you come back tomorrow with the right number to not lose your job?
Ask them.
There's an idea. What are some things you could ask them? And let's assume that you're not going to get access to the manager or the owner to ask them this question.
Mm-hmm.
Who could you ask what to?
An employee, maybe? I mean, I don't know.
What questions could you ask the employee to find out the information you need to find out so you don't get fired tomorrow morning?
I mean, what – I mean, if it's like what they're making, if it's – if they're –
Well, you know what you paid for dinner, right?
Right.
You could ask them, for example, hey, what's your average ticket?
Mm-hmm.
I paid $30. Is that about average?
Mm-hmm.
No, you know what? Most people pay $50. Most people buy more than you. Most people have wine. You didn't have wine. Your average ticket price is $50, not $30. Would that change your calculation?
Yeah, definitely.
Hey, are you open for breakfast, lunch, and dinner? I'm only here for dinner. We're not open for breakfast. We are open for lunch. We're not open for dinner. And we are open for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. What's your average ticket price for lunch? Oh, the ticket price for lunch is $25.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, how many times do you turn a table in a night? Do you normally have one person per one party per table, two parties per table, or three parties per table per night for dinner?
Mm-hmm.
How many times do you turn a table for lunch?
Right.
Are you open 5 days a week or 7 days a week?
Okay.
By asking a few questions, you can pretty reasonably estimate how much the restaurant grosses, couldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Now, with a few little pieces of information that you could look up on your phone while you're sitting at the table, you could probably estimate how much profit the owner takes from the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Do they have a bar or do they not have a bar? How much of that average ticket price, Mr. Waiter or Miss Waitress, comes from drinks? How much of that average ticket price comes from meals? Well, if you know that the liquor has a 70% markup, 70% profit, and the food has only a 10% profit, you can start to figure this out, right?
Mm-hmm.
You could do this for a restaurant, couldn't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, if you don't figure this out for your law firm, the day is going to come and they're going to fire you.
Mm-hmm.
How couldn't they fire you? They have to fire you if you don't get this together.
Yeah.
That would suck, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm, definitely.
Could you blame them?
No. I mean, if I'm going to be in charge of trying to increase revenue, I would have to know what I'm doing to do so, so...
Are you saying you couldn't blame them as a matter of fairness?
Yes.
What does fair have to do with anything? Why are you having a conversation about fair? Fair for them to pay you if you don't know how their business works?
Well, I feel like they would be wasting. I mean, if I'm not performing at the level they would want me to perform, but yet they're still paying me, it wouldn't be fair for them to waste their time and money.
Again, why are we having a conversation about fair? Do you mind if I ask how old are you?
Yeah.
And feel free to tell me none of my business.
Yeah, no, I'm 24.
Okay, so you're a millennial.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I have a millennial who works for me. Her name is Stephanie. Stephanie just turned 24 earlier this month. Stephanie's base salary is $100,000 a year. She knows that if she doesn't make $200,000 next year, she's fired.
Mm-hmm.
Stephanie will be making $200,000 a year by the time she's 25 years old. Stephanie's worked with me for 5 years. She started working with me 6 months out of high school.
Mm-hmm.
Stephanie understands that fair is not part of our vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
Fair leads to a sense of entitlement. You're entitled to have what's fair. Fuck entitlement.
Mm-hmm.
Forget about fair. I'm giving you some really good career advice. I hope you're paying attention. Stop focusing on fair. There's only pragmatic. Practically speaking, how much are they paying you?
I'm paid $17 an hour.
Do you think they're going to continue paying you $17 an hour if they're only grossing $189,000 a year between the two of them?
Probably not.
$189,000 a year between the two of them is – hold on, you said it's $20,000 a month. That's not $20,000 a month. What's 189 divided by 12?
15.
I'm pulling it up.
$15,000 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And what's $17 an hour times $40 an hour, times 40 hours?
680.
680 times 52?
35,360.
Okay. Do you think that it's realistic? Do you think that they're going to be able to afford to pay $35,000 or $40,000 a year if they're only making $15,000 a month between the two of them? I mean, you're practically making more money than they are.
Yeah.
You see why fair has nothing to do with this conversation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get it.
Okay. My point with all of this is – you've got to question everything.
Mm-hmm.
You are clearly an intelligent person. People who are not intelligent are not able to follow along with the kind of conversation you've been following along with.
Mm-hmm.
You're clearly a resilient person. People who are not resilient cannot take the pressure that I'm putting on you right now. You're clearly a curious and an inquisitive person. People who are not curious and not inquisitive don't call in to programs like this. So you're intelligent, resilient, inquisitive, and a curious person. And when someone tells you our law firm grossed $189,000 last year, just do some simple math. Divide that by 12. Wait a second, $15,000 a month? How much do we bill per hour? $300 an hour, you're talking – you mean 15,000 divided by 300 hours? Divided by 300 hours means we only bill 50 hours a month between the two of you?
Mm-hmm.
What the fuck are the two of you doing the rest of the time?
Yeah.
Do you understand where I'm trying to drive you to ask these questions?
Yeah, totally.
All right. Next thing that I want you to start to recognize is they don't know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Either they really grossed $189,000 last year, they're telling you the truth, and they're completely lost and have no idea how to run a law firm,
mm-hmm.
which is probably true.
Mm-hmm.
In which case, should you listen to anything they say about the business of running a law firm?
Not at this point.
Right?
Yeah.
Or they're lying to you about how much they grossed last year, and they don't know that it's a really, really, really stupid thing to not give your legal administrator all the information he or she needs to be successful, at which point you shouldn't be listening to them either.
Right. Well, especially if they want me to figure out ways to improve that, I would need to know exact numbers to see what I'm working with. So
I don't know. Do you want to say that it's – which one is giving them the benefit of the doubt? Which one is kinder to say that they are honest and don't know shit about the business running a law firm? Or is it kinder to say they know about the business of a law firm, but they're so stupid and self-destructive as to think that they should give you incorrect information?
Yeah, I think that.
You know what? I'll leave it up to you. You can decide which of the two you want. Either way, the conclusion is the same, which is you shouldn't be listening to much of what they have to say about the business of running a law firm.
Mm-hmm.
You have to learn about the business of running a law firm on your own.
Yeah. That's kind of what it's
and
felt like.
And I'm going to say one more. I'm sorry?
That's kind of what it's felt like for the past couple of months, you know, kind of just thrown in and, you know, kind of like figure this stuff out. So.
And I'm going to say one more thing that I hope you don't take offense to.
No, go ahead.
I think you are reasonable and mature enough to hear what I'm saying. And I don't mean mature from an age standpoint. I talk to people who are 50 years old who lack the emotional maturity to hear what I'm about to say.
No, it's okay.
Right?
I'm not very much of a snowflake is what about one of my teachers likes to call it as.
Here's my number one indictment against them that makes me think they don't know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Ready?
Yep.
They hired you to be the administrator for their firm.
Yeah, well, I mean, I myself questioned that too, kind of. Not the fact that I don't think I can do it, but the same thing you're thinking.
Exactly. It's like, wait a second. You two don't know that I don't know what I'm doing? How do you two not know that I don't know what I'm doing?
Yeah.
Now, the good news is you can learn. So
yeah.
Let me tell you a few things you need to do to learn. All right?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Number one, you need to join the Association of Legal Administrators.
Okay.
ALA.NET.ORG.
Mm-hmm.
Getting a...
Yeah, like I've said, I've been to some of their Chicago chapters here because that's where we are. So,
yeah.
I mean, I definitely know.
What city are you in?
Chicago.
Chicago, okay. So join the Association of Legal Administrators.
Mm-hmm.
If they won't pay for it, make the investment yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be a huge benefit for you if you plan to make a career in legal administration.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. ALA, by the way, is based in Chicago. That's their headquarters,
mm-hmm.
so there should
mm-hmm.
be some really good chapters there.
Yeah, there are. There are a lot, actually.
Good. Number two, pick up a book by Jay Foonberg, Foonberg.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking around my library, but I just moved to a different library in my house, so I don't see it. I must have left it downstairs. Jay Foonberg. Foonberg. The American Bar Association publishes his book. It's a classic on the business of running a law firm, a small law firm.
Okay.
Three, get a book called How to Read a Financial Report, published by Wiley Publishers, written by John Tracy and Tage Tracy. So Tracy and Tracy. How to Read a Financial Report by Tracy and Tracy. Scott, will you put this link to this on the membership site?
Yes.
Okay.
Got it.
And just start devouring all of the resources that are available to you on the membership site about the business of running a law firm.
Okay.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
You gotta go to school on the business of running a law firm.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to your original question of policies and procedures.
Mm-hmm.
There's two policies you need to create and enforce. One will be harder to enforce than the other.
Okay.
The first is you gotta create a policy and make sure that it's in writing. That is signed by every client when they sign their engagement agreement. So I guess question number one is, does every new client sign a written engagement agreement, yes or no?
Yes.
Good. Read the engagement agreement and make sure there's an evergreen clause in the engagement agreement that says you're required to keep a balance of X number of dollars in your trust account at all times, and when we get down to that number, we will send you an invoice to replenish your trust account. And if you don't replenish the trust account and we run out of money, you give us permission to withdraw from your case.
Mm-hmm.
That has to be in the engagement agreement.
Okay.
That's the easy part. This is the hard part. The hard part is when the client runs out of money in the trust account. So let's say they're required to keep a $2,000 cushion in the trust account.
Okay.
And they get down to $2,000 left in the trust account.
Mm-hmm.
Or $3,000. That gives them 10 hours of cushion in the trust account at $300 an hour, right?
Mm-hmm.
You get down to $300, you get to $3,000, and you issue an invoice to the client saying you need to replenish your trust account.
Mm-hmm.
We're now beginning to eat into your cushion.
Mm-hmm.
And when it gets to $1,500, you pick up the phone and you call the client and say, listen, we need a replenishment now. Give me your credit card. I'll take a credit card over the phone or bring a mm-hmm. check today. We need to replenish the trust account because when we get down to zero, we're only 5 hours away. We're going to have to stop working on your case.
Mm-hmm.
We're still on the easy part. You ready for the hard part?
Go for it.
The hard part comes when you get down to zero and you go into the lawyer's office and you take the file away from them and you say, you're not allowed to work on this file anymore because we're not going to work for free.
Mm-hmm.
And the lawyer will then raise all kinds of holy hell with you about who the hell do you think you are, and you don't understand, and there's these extenuating circumstances, and blah, 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 blah. And you mm-hmm. basically take out a picture of the lawyer's kid, and you say, listen, you want to borrow money from his trust account, borrow money from his college fund? Because that's what you're paying for now. The client isn't paying us. The client's not going to pay us. You're now working for free, and you're borrowing money from your kid's college fund to pay for this client's case.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's the policy. The policy is unless the lawyer can make a case that there's, you know, going to be an emergency or some horrible thing that happens to the client, we have to stop work if we're not getting paid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's
now, two lawyers who together only grossed $189,000 doing family law in Chicago. Excuse me, how do you only do $189,000 in Chicago doing family law?
Yeah. Agree.
Two lawyers who are only doing $189,000 between the two of them in Chicago doing family law and hire someone to run their business who doesn't know anything about how to run the business of a law firm, but you're studying and you're learning and you're growing and you're going to become a superstar pretty soon, it makes me think that they're running their law firm mostly based on ego.
Mm-hmm.
And they're getting paid with a lot of compliments. And you got to look up for lawyers to get paid with compliments instead of money.
Yeah.
Because you can't pay the bills with compliments.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of lawyers will take compliments in lieu of cash. And that does a disservice to all the rest of their clients who depend on them not to be broke and starving.
Mm-hmm.
How did you end up joining this program?
How to Manage a Small Law Firm?
Yeah.
Through him, actually.
What do you mean through him? Don't say the lawyer's name. I don't want to know.
No, he's actually a member himself.
Oh, he's a member of How to Manage a Small Law Firm?
Mm-hmm. He
comes to the live quarterly meetings, he has a CEO, or he just joined us?
He just joined, so this is actually like the first one that he wasn't able to.
Arjun, he's a member of the All Digital membership.
Oh, he doesn't have a CEO or a COO or a CFO?
No, he's just a member of the All Digital membership.
Got it. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Listen. I'm just going to give you some more friendly career advice to give you some confidence, okay?
Please do.
There is a lot of demand for people to help administer law firms. Mm-hmm. It's a very in-demand career. Mm-hmm. A good legal administrator is earning $90,000 to $150,000 a year.
Jeez.
An experienced legal administrator, $90,000 to $150,000 a year. In the big law firms, mm-hmm. like if you see a big law firm with like multiple offices and hundreds of lawyers, legal mm-hmm. administrators there are earning $200,000 to $250,000 a year. They usually have an MBA or a finance degree or something like that,
mm-hmm.
or a business degree. But in small law firms, what did you say your undergraduate was?
Criminal justice.
Yeah, that's not really going to be relevant or helpful. But you can educate yourself. You can get a member. You can become a member of the Association of Legal Administrators. You can mm-hmm. become a certified legal manager. CLM mm-hmm. is the designation.
Mm-hmm.
You become a certified legal manager, and you can walk into a lot of law firms, a lot of law firms. And they'll hire you for $75,000 to $90,000 starting, and you'll be earning $100,000 to $120,000 with performance-based compensation before you're 26 years old.
That would be ideal. That'd be great.
Well, it'd be great to do that with the firm you're already at.
Yeah.
The point that I'm trying to make here is you should not fear doing the right thing for this firm.
Yeah, I agree.
Getting fired by this firm for doing the right thing is like a good thing to put on your resume when you go for the interview with the next firm. Well, what happened to the last firm? I see you announced, you know, you left there in less than a year or a year and a half or whatever the number is. The answer is I got fired when I tried to enforce a policy to protect them from drowning in accounts receivables.
Mm-hmm.
That's like music to the ears of a person who knows how to run a law firm. Don't fear that.
Okay.
Okay. Did I answer your question?
All right.
Yeah.
She's like, yeah. And yeah. He gave me a whole bunch of other advice I didn't ask for, too.
Yeah, you can
all
go
right,
ahead Scott. If you have a heart.
Thanks.
All right. Yadi, I want to thank you for your question. Yeah, we're done. Yadi, thank you for your question.
Yeah.
Arjun, thank you for your time. Thank you for investing in everybody in the membership of All Digital on how to manage a small law firm. As Arjun mentioned, and I will say it again, next month on our coaching call, we're going to have a raffle for you to join Arjun and myself and hundreds of other successful lawyers so that you can see what they're doing in their law firm at our live quarterly meeting. Normally, this is only for what we call our C-suite members, which is a higher level membership in our program. And we're going to make it available only by way of a raffle. We're going to give you a couple free tickets to be able to attend that. And so be sure you mark your calendar for our next coaching call coming up on November. I'm going to pull the date here. I just want to make sure I've got it correct, but it should be November 15th. Yes, November 15th at 1 o'clock Eastern time. Of course, I'll send you all the reminders. I'll put the reminder about the raffle in the email so that we can get as many people. But you must be present on that coaching call on November 15th at 1 o'clock Eastern time in order to be able to win. So that is your entry ticket to be able to win the two free tickets to join us at the live quarterly meeting coming up in January. So, Arjun, that's very generous of you because I know normally – that's only available to our higher-level members, so I want to thank you for that. Thank you for your time today. Thank you to everyone who asked questions. Thank you for allowing us to partner with you and to come alongside you and to help you grow your law firm. If there's anything that we can do, don't hesitate to email me or post in our forum inside the membership site. And, by the way, we're constantly updating that. Some of you may have seen the most recent email I sent out last week, where I updated our tools and what's working now with some additional policies and procedure templates that you can use and implement in your law firm. So if you've got a need and there's something that I can do to help help you, I'll be glad to do that, and I'll be glad to add it to that library that we're constantly building and upgrading. So thank you for our call today. Thank you, Carrie. Again, thank you, Arjun. And we'll talk to you next time.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.